Welcome to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike, your host, Dr. Michael McGee. I hope you're having a good week so far, and we're happy to have you with us again. Today we're going to be talking about a little bit of an unusual topic. We're going to be talking about love and cults, and we have with us an expert on cults and an expert on treating survivors of cult experiences, and her name is Natalie Feinblatt. Natalie, Dr. Feinblatt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really grateful to be here.
How interesting that you got into treating cult survivors. Can you tell our audience a little bit about how that happened? How did you fall into this kind of work?
Sure. A question that a lot of people ask me is, you know, are you a former cult member? And the answer is no. That's not kind of where my interest came from. I'll try to make a long story short, but my father worked in the film industry, and when I was around 10 years old, he worked on a movie starring a famous movie star who was also famously known for belonging to a strange and controversial religion. And at the time, I found it very interesting. I was a precocious kid, and I thought it was weird that all the grown-ups were talking about this stuff, but nobody could really tell me more about what this group or what they believed. So flash forward to my high school years when the internet became a thing. I started to research this group, and I found that there were many people who had left and were telling their stories, and I found it fascinating. And from there, I went on to read about all the other cults I could get my hands on. And then when I was finally doing my dissertation, my doctoral program, rather, in psychology, I ended up doing my dissertation on, with a literature review on therapy with former cult members, and it's been a part of my professional life ever since then.
Very, very interesting. Well, you know, our show is really about talking about the art of loving, the skill of loving, the practice of loving, the capacity of loving and being loved. In developing that capacity, and as you know, Dr. Feinblatt, not everybody is raised and taught through actual experience how to skillfully and effectively love and be loved, and so people go into adulthood with a yearning to love and be loved that sometimes never got filled as children. Do you see that as increasing a vulnerability to being attracted to a cult at all?
I could certainly see that as a vulnerability. I mean, you know, there is no stereotypical profile of a potential cult member. Just about anybody is vulnerable. However, I could certainly see, you know, something that many groups are known for, at least in the beginning, is something called love bombing, which is, you know, showering a new member with attention and praise and affection. And if that's something that you didn't get a lot as a child or really don't know how to cultivate in your life as an adult, I could absolutely see how that could reel somebody in.
Oh, that's very interesting, huh? Mm-hmm. They call it love bombing?
Yeah, love bombing is a technique that's often used in cults, and then a lot of people also identify it as something that people with, like, narcissistic personality disorder do in their relationships, at least initially. To kind of reel people in so they, you know, get really close to them really quickly. It's definitely something that a lot of abusive groups do as well.
Oh, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, tell us a little bit about cults and survivors. I mean, in terms of our audience and our topic, what do you think is most important for people to know about cults and that experience?
Well, I mean, we already touched on one thing a little bit, which is that, you know, and just about anybody is susceptible to being pulled into an abusive group like a cult. You know, oftentimes there's a lot of stuff. Popular culture kind of comes in waves. Like right now we're getting all of these kind of documentaries on HBO about Nixium and Heaven's Gate and all of these different groups. And oftentimes people will watch those and just kind of go, oh, man, that's so crazy. I don't know how anybody would ever fall for that. I would never fall for that. And I think it's an important thing to put out there that actually you could fall for that. You know, people who join these kinds of groups are not stupid, strange people. They are often quite smart people who are looking to find answers and help themselves and help others. And I think that's something that, you know, most people would be, you know, drawn to. So that's one thing that I like to put out there is to, you know, don't think of yourself as immune to, you know, falling victim to something like this. And I guess another good thing to know about cults is that they come in all shapes and sizes. They also don't have to be religious or spiritual in nature. Certainly plenty of cults are, but there are, you know, as we can see with all of this stuff up there about Nixium, there are, you know, like psychology or self-help cults, there's business cults.
What did you say, I'm sorry, Nixium or could you spell that for us?
Well, it's a strange word, N-X-I-V-M, pronounced Nixium.
N-X-I-V-M.
Yeah.
What kind of cult is that?
So they were a group that existed in upstate New York for, gosh, 20 or 30 years. And within the last couple of years, they finally started getting exposed. And there was just a very popular docuseries on HBO called The Vow about them that got a lot of people's attention. And they were kind of a hybrid of, like, psychology, self-help, and multi-level marketing. They had no religious or spiritual component at all. So I think it's important for people to remember that, you know, an abusive group can form around just about any ideology. It doesn't have to be spiritual or religious in nature.
Yeah, I'm trying to Google that, and I may have the spelling wrong. Could you? I have N-X-I-Z-M.
Oh, sorry, it's N. N as in Nancy.
Oh, N as in Nancy, X-I... VM, is it?
Yep.
VM. Just so our listeners know, NXIVM.
Yeah.
And is this a multi-level marketing company of some sort?
Yeah, it was a mixture of multi-level marketing, and he also stole a lot of concepts from psychology. They had kind of their own form of therapy that they would do with people. And it ended up, you know, he's now in jail. The leader isn't going to be in jail for the rest of his life for some of the illegal activities that he was involved in, which is actually kind of nice because it's pretty rare that victims of cults see legal justice served. So this was actually kind of a nice change that something actually did happen to the person that did all this damage.
Yeah, very interesting. That brings up the question, Dr. Pineblatt, Doc. Given that the cults come in all different shapes and sizes, what are sort of the general definition or characteristics of a cult?
Sure. So there is no one agreed upon definition or set of criteria out there that, like, everybody uses. The ones that I prefer to use, I mean, there's some pretty good ones out there, and I can go over them briefly, but Dr. Margaret Singer has a really good list. Dr. Robert Lifton has a great one. And then Steve Hassan, who's he's an expert in the field of cults, came up with his own model called the BITE model. My most basic, a bit overgeneralized definition of a cult is it's a group that abuses and exploits its members. That is an oversimplification, but that is essentially the heart and soul of a cult, if you were to ask me. So in terms of, you know, like Dr. Margaret Singer's criteria or even Robert Lifton's, you know, they both talk about things like groups that have a very black or white, in or out view, you know. Our version of reality is the only valid version of reality. You're either in the group or you are out and, you know, never the twain shall meet. Groups often control a person's, you know, social or physical environment. Groups will, you know, insist that you spend all of your time and or money with them, and they kind of don't allow for much outside contact. They often are very authoritarian in nature. you know, where only one person at the top or a few people at the top get to make the decisions and they answer to no one and they really can't be questioned. Those are some of the kind of broad brushstrokes of what makes a group a cult.
Okay, well, that's a great description. And what you're saying is that quote-unquote normal people, or just everyday people, all of us are susceptible to being drawn into a cult. Can you say a little bit more about that? What about that susceptibility that we may all have? Well, how come that is that we all might be susceptible?
Well, first of all, I mean, most of these groups, unfortunately, are very good at employing manipulative tactics, right? So it's not even that, you know, people are necessarily having to be, you know, out there looking for answers or looking for a group to join. You know, if a recruiter for one of these groups just happens to hit you with the right technique at the right time, that could at least get your foot in the door. And quite frankly, that could happen to just about anybody. We're all susceptible to being manipulated every now and then, you know.
What kind of manipulative tactics did they use, Dr. Mike?
Well, I mean, you know, we talked about one earlier, which was love bombing, you know.
Yeah,
when
right.
you first join a group, if everybody wants to talk to you, everybody thinks you're amazing, everybody's telling you that you're, you know, a member of a family and they love you so much, you know, I mean, gosh, who wouldn't want to hang out with people like that?
Yeah,
you know,
exactly. We all love to be loved.
Sounds pretty nice.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then I think the other thing is just that, you know, many people out there are looking for answers, right? We're looking for what does life mean? What am I supposed to do with myself? And I think any group that purports to give you, you know, definite answers on that can be attractive at certain points in your life.
Yeah, right. So if you're a searcher and a seeker for answers, you're lost. What does my life mean? What's the purpose and how do I live my life? The purpose and method of living, or if you're, like I said, maybe being a little bit vulnerable to that yearning to be loved and belong. And I think that's another thing, don't you think? Is don't you, if people are offering a sense of group connection and a community identity, don't we as human beings yearn for a sense of connection and belonging to a group?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely, 100%. And like you said earlier, especially if you come from a family where there wasn't a very healthy or loving system, you know, you still kind of might have it in you to really want to be a part of something like that. So if a group kind of portrays itself that way, and that's what you're looking for, of course that's going to be attractive to you.
Okay. So you sort of seduce people with giving them a sense of love, belonging, connection, meaning, method, purpose, structure that feels in some ways very soothing and feels very, very good. But the leaders are doing this for their own personal egocentric gain, I would guess. What are the leaders trying to get out of this?
Well, it really depends on the group. The specifics of what the leader is trying to get really depends on the group.
Uh-huh.
But honestly, it usually boils down to power. They want power, and power can take many forms. For many groups, it's financial power, right? Like, give me all your money, sign over all your assets to me, you know, pay for all these services, and, you know, the group collects a huge coffer of funds. Sometimes it's just about money, but oftentimes it's also about having psychological power over people, right? Being able to, you know, you say jump and everybody says how high, you know, having that kind of control over people for somebody who's, you know, highly narcissistic can be really intoxicating. So it's usually some form of power, often multiple forms of power.
Yeah, I see. So it's really power over people, control of them, psychological, financial. Are these leaders generally are they suffering from narcissistic or psychopathic damage to their personalities in general, do you think?
Generally speaking, yeah. You know, I mean,
yeah,
I'm sure there are a few exceptions, but generally speaking, yes. If not other sorts of mental health issues, but most often the answer is yes.
Okay. And they can be very charming and charismatic, I would imagine.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing, is that, you know, if people were being abusive or exploitative right off the bat, nobody would join these groups, right? Something draws them in, whether it's a really awesome-looking leader, charismatic leader, or something. You know, people get drawn in kind of under false pretenses, and by the time things start to take a turn, they have sunk so much time and money in that some people, you know, it's hard for them to leave.
So you mentioned power and sort of psychological control of people serving them and doing what they say. Mm-hmm. Do you ever see a cult where there's the desire for power over people sexually?
Oh, absolutely, yes. That comes up in a lot of groups. I mean, Nixium would be a great example, unfortunately, that often the power also involves, you know, having sexual control over people and being, you know, coercing people into sexually abusive situations. That can absolutely be a part of the control.
Yeah, okay. So you've done a lot of treatment of survivors. I mean, what happens? So if somebody goes into a cult, and I'm fantasizing that at first all is well and wonderful, and there's a high, and you know, there's a Dr. Mark Galantra, I don't know if he's worked, he's a colleague of mine, and we both are very interested in the issue of spirituality and well-being, and and in his study of that, he has studied, I think, the Moon cult.
He studied
that one. Yeah, the Moonies. Mm-hmm. And he said that actually in his studies that when people got into cults, there was actually reductions in depression and anxiety, the enhancements of overall well-being, the sense of belonging to a family that they had never experienced before, and decreased alcohol and substance use, that really actually people felt better and did better when they first got involved, with Reverend Moon's church and the research that he did.
Yeah, I don't have a problem believing that. I mean, you know, I think there's probably a couple things at play there. One is probably the placebo effect, that just by doing some sort of different activity, people found that certain things changed for them, whether it was depression or their substance use or whatever. And, you know, you attribute it to the thing that you're doing differently, which is this church. But honestly, it could probably be anything. Doing differently might have changed things. I would also be curious, you know, if these people, once you're in kind of the beginning stages of being in a cult, you know, you're going to be reporting kind of overly positive stuff because it goes along with what you're being taught to do in the group. So I would also just be wondering if that was based on self-report, how honest those self-reports are. You know, just because people might not want to be going against the group and saying, yeah, the group's helping me with all this stuff, when the reality might not be quite as rosy as they're portraying it to be. And then I just will also say that, like, again, people don't initially get involved in cults because they don't offer something, right? Like, people get involved in these groups because initially they seem good and helpful, right? And they sound positive and like they're going to be of assistance to their lives. And that might actually be the case for a little while, right? While they're still kind of getting into the group a little bit. So, they wouldn't stick around if something wasn't working, at least initially.
Right, exactly. So they seduce them in, give them this belonging, community, love, warmth, meaning, structure, purpose. It all feels great. People feel better, and maybe they stop addiction behaviors, as the literature that I'm aware of has suggested sometimes. And they're doing great. And then what happens? What happens after that?
Well, I mean, it can go in a couple different or several different directions. For people who eventually leave, what often happens is that sooner or later they will start to run up against information that contradicts what they've been taught to believe about the group. You know, for example, if you're taught to believe that, like, you know, oh, the group leader is this, you know, celibate monk-like person, but you're finding out that they actually are having sex with a bunch of different members of the group. or you're being told, you know, that, you know, money is going in one direction, but you find out it's going in another one.
So then the barriers, the cracks in the integrity of the group come out. And wait a minute, this isn't what I was told. Wait a minute, there's something nefarious going on here, or this is there's something not right going on. And then people sort of get a signal, wait a minute, this isn't as it was presented to me. I've been sold a bill of goods, and this isn't quite the truth of what I was sold then. Is that kind of what you're
right.
saying?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, that makes sense. Well, good. Well, we're going to take a brief break here, and we'll be back right after this. We're talking with Dr. Natalie Feinblatt about cults, and we talked a little bit about that, and I think when we come back, we'll talk about sort of what happens to people psychologically, and then how the treatment or healing from that occurs. So please stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Michael McGee, your host here, with our cult expert guest, Dr. Natalie Feinblatt. Welcome back to Feinblatt.
Thank you.
So can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, people have gotten into a cult, and what is the psychological impact of what happens to people psychologically as a result of being in a cult?
Well, it really depends on the specific group because, you know, at the very least, when somebody is in an occult and an abusive group, they are being psychologically manipulated and abused in some way. And then on top of that, depending on the group or the person's experience in the group, they might also experience, you know, financial abuse or sexual abuse. So what it does to a person psychologically really depends on, like, their specific experience. But, you know, if we're talking about somebody who, let's say, that, you know, they, quote-unquote, just experienced, you know, psychological coercion and manipulation, I mean, that in and of itself can be a tough thing to recover from because it makes you doubt yourself. It usually gives you a pretty strong hit to your self-esteem because you start to think, how could I have been so stupid to get involved in something like this? And then depending on the beliefs of the group, you know, there could have been a lot of gaslighting involved in what was going on in the group, and so you might come out of that having trouble trusting your perception of reality. You might need to work on that for a while. And there could also just be the process of trying to reconstruct a life, because if you've been in the group long enough, the group probably became your life. So once you leave, you need to create a life for yourself, and it might have been a while since you practiced the skills needed for something like that.
Okay, so I'm hearing a lot of things here. There can be sexual abuse, financial abuse, emotional abuse. There's a sense of a damage to your self-esteem. How could I believe all that? Mm-hmm. And then people sort of having a doubt about what's true or not because of gaslighting and a sense of invalidating their experience, being told that what they experience and think is wrong. Very interesting. Are there some people who stay in these cults long term and never escape? And
absolutely.
Is there a difference between the people who stay and those who leave? And what is that difference?
Well, I think that the people who eventually leave, you know, let me put it this way. So, you know, cognitive dissonance is the discomfort caused by, you know, holding conflicting beliefs, right? For a lot of people, they have the belief that they are a, you know, smart, capable, successful person, but they might also have this other information about the group that, what, I belong to this group that might be abusive and, you know, taking my money, and those two beliefs don't really square, right? So I think the difference is that the people who eventually leave are willing to really face that cognitive dissonance and say, something is wrong here. I need to look at this. I can't ignore it anymore. Whereas the people who stay for, you know, a long time or possibly their entire life, are people who were never really willing to take that step and say, you know, these two things don't match up. I need to look at this. Something isn't right here.
You know, what you said is I think is so incredibly important and really applies to this issue of love and the experiences we have in our families growing up where we're told to believe a certain set of beliefs about the world and given a worldview to believe in that may or may not have contradictions in it. I'm reminded, Dr. Feinberg, you probably heard about the famous research where they'll take a group of maybe four or five or six people and they'll draw, you know, maybe three lines. And one line will be a little bit shorter than the other line. And then they'll have four of the people in the group, I'm just making this up, but four of them be trained to say that one line is shorter, even though it's not the shorter line. And then they'll go around and then they'll go to the fifth person who's the test subject, and the test subject will have to choose which is the shorter line. And oftentimes, if everybody else says another line is shorter, I mean, I can't remember the number, but like four times out of five, the test subject will agree with them and go against their own perception and say, yes, I guess this other line is shorter because everybody else says it's shorter and I don't want to disagree with the group.
Yeah, no, that's a very, important and famous study on groupthink and compliance and all of that stuff, yes.
So I would imagine that's a factor. You're in a cult and everybody's saying that this is all wonderful and the things, the contradictions you're seeing about the money or the sex, I mean, we also have this amazing way to rationalize. So there's a way to rationalize any kind of abusive or inappropriate behavior. And I'm sure that there must be the cohesion of the group, I would imagine, to sort of have a coherent set of rationalizations. That's got to be pretty powerful to go against. I would imagine if you were a cult member and you were getting all these goodies from the cult, that to sort of go against that would take tremendous clarity and courage, I would think.
100%. Yes, absolutely. To be that five out of five person who says, no, I don't see what you guys see. I am perceiving things differently, and I'm willing to say something and trust that takes a ton of strength. It is, you know, the former cult members that I work with in my practice are some of the strongest people I've ever met because they have had to do that, and then they've also had to lose a lot in their lives in order to stick with their belief that they know the truth, and it goes against some of our instincts to do that.
Yeah, you know, and so I'm just, again, I've never thought this before, and I'm just so grateful to you, Dr. Feinbach, for this discussion because it's still triggering in me new ideas and associations that I've never thought of before. But I'm having the thought, for the first time in my life, I'm having the thought that in a way, how are families similar to or different from cults? And are there cult-like families with maybe members of the heads of the families that have narcissism or psychopathy or whatever who...
Yeah.
Engage in these same kind of behaviors to me and basically abuse and extort their own family members. Do you see any similarities there at all?
100%. And people who know me have heard me talk about this, which is that the longer I specialize in this specific area, and I also work with a lot of trauma survivors who've never been in a cult, but who come from highly abusive and dysfunctional families, the longer I do this work, the more I see that highly abusive and dysfunctional families are often just really tiny cults.
Yeah.
You know, cults of three, four, five people, you know.
I have never, ever had that thought before. Thank you so, so much. Because a lot of these dynamics would be very, very, very much the same, I would think. Yeah.
Very similar. A lot of similarities, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, this is great. Well, we're going to take a brief break. We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike, with our cult expert guest, Dr. Natalie Feinblatt. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike, with our guest, Dr. Natalie Feinblatt, talking about cults. Welcome back, Ms. Feinblatt.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You know, in our previous segment, you talked, and I had the realization which you affirmed that, in a way, the families that have a lot of narcissism and maybe psychopathy among the head of the family, mm-hmm. that these families can really be like tiny little cults. And
yeah.
I'm imagining a lot of our listeners may have had experiences of abuse and exploitation. Maybe a father who gave them candy to their daughter in exchange for having sex with the daughter or something like that. I can just imagine, and then creating sort of an explanation or a story or rationalization and gaslighting about why this was appropriate and good and normal.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just, with that kind of thought, if people can resonate with this, the sense that their things don't add up, or they're feeling exploited or abused either in a cult or in their own family in some way, how can they deal with the situation? How can they get out? How can they free themselves? And how can they heal from what they've been through?
Well, you know, either instance, whether it's a, you know, a quote-unquote official cult or abusive group or a really abusive family, oftentimes the first step is to get some sort of outside help or outside perspective, because more often than not, in these situations, the group is very insular and tight-knit, and there's not a lot of going outside of the system that is permitted, because heaven forbid if you get exposed to, like, alternative or potentially critical viewpoints, right?
Right.
So oftentimes it involves maybe, it could even be as small as starting to talk to a friend or relative that is outside of the group, and kind of discussing your concerns with that person to kind of get some validation there. And if the person is, you know, able to and has the resources to, it could also mean starting to see a therapist. You know, and I've certainly been in the situation as the therapist in those cases where sometimes the person isn't officially out of the group yet, and they are kind of seeing me in secret, because they're afraid that if word gets out that they're seeing a therapist to talk about concerns they have about the group, that, you know, that won't go well for them. So oftentimes the first step is to just start to talk to somebody outside of the group to kind of see if your perspective and your critiques are something that other people share.
Very good. So get some outside, an independent, kind of neutral, objective
mm-hmm. yeah.
opinion. So you get some sort of validation of your reality testing is what mm-hmm. you're saying. Is that right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. And then what? So I'm not crazy. The way I'm seeing things, these conflicts, wow, this is happening. Yes, I mm-hmm. see it. That could be a very terrifying place to be in. You're in the family, you're in the cult, and mm-hmm. you're seeing this all clearly. I would imagine that would be very, very frightening.
It certainly can be, because, you know, more often than not, the idea of leaving a group like this, it means, you know, potentially losing all of your social support. Because, again, these groups can be very insular, so you might not have any friends outside of this group. You might have kind of burned bridges with family at the behest of this group, and you might not be sure if you can go back to your family. Never mention the fact that you might have become, you know, financially destitute because, you know, you've given all of your money to this group. So it can be extremely scary to be at that precipice of, like, I know something is wrong here. I know I have to get out, but do I have the social or financial resources to even make that happen? That can be extremely scary.
So what do you do if you're in that situation?
Well, you know, what I would suggest to people is, you know, if you have any relationships that exist outside of the group, even if they're ones that you've kind of become disconnected from, I don't think it hurts to try and see if those people are willing to come back into your life now that you're trying to get out of this group. You know, you might be surprised that people are, you know, willing to help now that they know that you've kind of, quote-unquote, seen the light and you need help exiting the situation. You know, I work with a lot of people who struggle with addiction as well, and this pops up in those cases as well, because it's like, Yeah, there are family members or friends that you got disconnected to because you were so in your addiction, but now that you're trying to get sober, these people might be interested in helping you, right? Because you're moving in a healthy direction now. Same thing with leaving an abusive group. You might think, oh, God, I haven't talked to my Aunt Shirley in 10 years. But if Aunt Shirley hears that you're interested in leaving this group, she might be interested in trying to help you out with that.
Yeah.
So I would say to explore those options. And then also, you know, if worse comes to worse and you have to get yourself into a homeless shelter, sign up for food stamps, get a, you know, minimum wage job and struggle for a while in order to start to build something outside of this group, then that, if that's what it has to come to, that may be the way that you have to get out.
Are there any kind of, like, cult survivor groups that
yes.
sort of provide each other support?
Yes. You know, some of the things that I know about that are very helpful to survivors, there's a group called the International Cultic Studies Association, which has kind of its own survivors branch that do conferences and support groups for survivors. There's also a group called FACT, Families Against Cultic Teachings, that provide assistance to survivors and, I believe, support groups. And there may also be, it can be very interesting if you go online and Google, you know, former NXIVM member, I'll just use them again, you might find an online community of other former members that you can connect with because they also left and had nothing and have tried to make something work. So, you know, the Internet is your friend in that regard, that you can probably connect with other people, either other former cult members or maybe even former members of the group you're leaving, and they could hook you up with resources or at least directions to go.
I chose any kind of group therapy where you could get support. A lot of process groups are people who suffered various types of trauma. And I would imagine that any kind of support, but what I'm hearing you say is ask for help, seek out support, and ask
yeah.
for help
yeah.
to get out. This is something that you really can't do on your own if you're in that situation.
Mm-hmm.
And how can people reach you if they would like your help?
Sure.
Are you available to help people with this?
I am. I am available. I have a private practice, and a good chunk of my clients are former cult members. You know, the easiest way to find me is either through my website or social media, and my website will be back up again soon, drnataliefeinblatt.com, and then I'm also on Instagram at Healing with Dr. Natalie.
Healing with Dr. Natalie on Instagram.
Yes.
And people can reach you through Instagram that way?
Yeah, if you DM me through Instagram, I will see that, and we can, you know, set up a phone call.
Okay.
I do free 20-minute phone consults for people who might
okay.
be interested in working together. More than happy to do that or
okay.
even just hook you up with some resources.
Oh, that's so great. And I just
mm-hmm.
want to point out for your website, although it's not up today, maybe people could check it. Well, by the time this recording gets posted, I'm sure it'll be working.
Yes.
But it's Dr. Natalie, Natalie. And then,
mm-hmm.
so people know Feinblatt is spelled Feinblatt. There's two T's
yeah.
at the end. And so, yeah, so Dr. Feinblatt, you have been just a wonderful guest in terms of enlightening us to this. And I think especially important to see how, even to look back at our own families, for people who have grown up in damaged families, how there could
mm-hmm.
be those cult-like aspects to it. That's really a brilliant realization for many of our listeners who may not even be involved in a former cult. I want to thank you so much for your time, for being on the How to Love Show, and want to wish you the best in all of your future endeavors. Thank you for the work that you do.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Good to have you. You're listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Michael McGee. And our guest, Dr. Natalie Feinblatt. I'll be right back to close out the last section of this show right after this brief break. Welcome back to the How to Love Show with Dr. Mike. We've been talking today about cults and really, Dr. Feinblatt, I thought was so wasn't she a great guest, talking about the phenomenon of cults. And I guess I'll just pre-associate on this for a little bit, in that it just is so compelling to me that we all so much want to love and belong, and we all so much want to have a sense of purpose and meaning to our lives, and we all want to have a sense that we kind of know what life is all about and what the answers are to the big questions of life are, and it can be so hard to live with uncertainty and mystery, and it can be so hard to live in our society with a sense of fragmentation or broken connection. So there are all these really, really compelling forces that really pull on us as human beings to get involved in groups for belonging, for connection, for meaning, for love, for purpose, for the certainty of maybe a way of seeing things or a belief in how things are. We all so much want to believe and feel that we know. And if a cult or a family or a political party even can sort of say, well, this is the way things are, and these are the issues, and this is what you should believe, and to give you that kind of certainty and simple, pat, right answers. And then if you can have sense of, well, we believe the same thing, so we're connected, and this bonds us together. I think it's important to see our vulnerability to those kinds of dynamics. They're kind of a double-edged sword, aren't they? It's so important for us to feel a sense of connection and community and belonging. But you can see how, under the wrong kind of leadership, a leadership that has narcissistic or psychopathic features. And what does that mean? So leaders who are narcissistic are leaders who, at their core, don't have a sense of their own sacredness, their own sort of unconditional goodness and worth and value. That's at the core of that narcissistic wound in anybody who suffers from narcissism. And, you know, to some degree, we all have that narcissistic vulnerability. And we all unconsciously, to some degree, look to other people to affirm us and validate us and tell us that we're good and lovable. We're all vulnerable to that. Most people really like to be told that they're really wonderful and that they're really, that we're loved and cared for. That's a universal human vulnerability. So to some degree, we all have that narcissistic vulnerability to that sort of sense of, you know, how good and valuable and whole and am I. And so people who have a real strong narcissistic wound, basically their life agenda comes to trying to heal that wound, because it's a terrible thing to feel that you're either bad or unworthy or unlovable. And with real bad narcissism, people, it's just so excruciatingly painful to feel that people with narcissism just cover up that. They don't even know they feel that way hardly, because they flip into a defense of grandiosity where they really focus on preoccupation, almost like a compulsive, it's almost like a thought addiction where you're almost addicted to a system or a way of thinking that revolves about how great and wonderful you are, as a way of compensating for how unlovable you feel at your core. And so what people with narcissism, with this illness, what they struggle with is really a life agenda of getting everybody else to love them and affirm them and tell them how great they are, and really to seek status and affirmation and validation and admiration from other people. So if you have that kind of wound, and if you're smart, and if you're charismatic, and if you're charming, and then that can really make it where you have this capacity to create a group, whether it be in a family or in a political party or in a cult, where you attract through your charm and manipulation. For example, like Dr. Feinblatt said, love bombing other people. You attract the people and sort of give them a little bit of what they want in order to get what you want from them in return. Now, with psychopathy, it's a little bit different from narcissism, although the two often go together. With psychopathy, there really is this intense desire to control and take from others for your own gain. With narcissism, it's really just what you're wanting to take is other people's admiration and get their admiration of you and validation of how wonderful you are. With psychopathy, you are really wanting to take from other people what generally egoic mediated drives, like it could be for wealth or material success or power over other people, get people to serve you, to do things for you. It could be for sex. Generally, it's around sort of self-aggrandizement in all these different ways to serve egoic drives. And so somebody with psychopathy will get into these powerful leadership positions and then engage in these manipulations generally to enhance their own position, their own social position in some way. And we see this in political leaders. And what they use is manipulative tactics like we're all so wonderful, that group out there is bad, that group is responsible for all of your problems. They create this kind of us versus them mentality. And you can see this at all different levels. You can see this in families. You can see this in your local organization. You see it in a benign way in terms of fanhood with teams where one team identifies itself against other teams. We really have this vulnerability to this us versus them kind of thinking that people with narcissism and with psychopathy can really, really exploit. So it's really good to know what our vulnerabilities are. It's really honor our, that we all have this yearning to be loved and to belong and to connect. A sense of meaning and purpose that we share with other people for serving something greater than ourselves. But we have to be very, very careful about who we connect with in doing this. And I think there needs to be a certain tolerance of a certain degree of uncertainty and just living knowing that we're partly wrong all the time. We may not know how we're wrong, but all of our beliefs are not 100% correct. That takes real humility and a tolerance of uncertainty. And if you see contradictions in what people in your group, in your family, your work group, in your school, in your organization, in your political party, whatever, if you see contradictions, really don't just sort of shut down to just denying or rationalizing or disregarding those. Have an open, inquisitive mind and seek outside support and be open to the outside reflections and perceptions of other people. I always have that sort of that idea, a little bit of, what is this? What is this? And a little bit of, don't know for sure. That tentativeness, that inquisitiveness, that curiosity, that courage to question, the courage to question and the courage to ask for help. And if you find yourself in a toxic social situation where you feel trapped in a group of any size that has these cult-like qualities, really have the courage to ask for help and seek input, validation, and assistance from outside the group that you find yourself entangled with. Really, I think that was a great lesson from Dr. Feinblatt today, and I hope for anybody who might find themselves in this kind of situation that the show today is helpful to you. So those are some thoughts. I really hope you have a great week. I hope it's a week of love and joy and fulfillment for you, and that you'll join us next week. Thanks very much for listening to the How to Love Show with Dr. Michael McGee, and if you want to learn more about me and my work, I'm at howtolove.com. Until next week, take care.